Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peep State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peep State Pandemonium.
Good evening. It's Thursday evening, August the 24th. This is Michael Norris, and I'm joined by Gary Oates, and we finally are back to a full staff. Mr. Simmons has given up his position with the Atlanta Falcons, and he has decided to rejoin the Peach State Pandemonium crew, and so welcome back, Bobby Simmons.
Well, thank you. I got an email from one of our listeners that said last 2 weeks' shows was the best two we'd ever done. So I was looking for a ball game to go to, but I just couldn't come up with one. So
I
actually called in last week on my cell phone at the beginning of the show, and y'all wouldn't put me on, so I finally hung up.
Well, Bobby, how are your Falcons gonna do? I hate to tell you, I don't know.
I've learned, I hadn't learned not to quit buying the tickets, but I've learned I don't get too excited about nothing they do, because if they win, it's just, you know, well, that's nice. But if they lose, I don't get too dejected anymore. I don't think they did enough to improve the defense this year, and the offense is, it looks pretty good as long as the first string's in. But if we lost an offensive lineman this week for the season, he hurt his arm. If we have to go into anything behind the first string, we're in trouble.
That's a mess, ain't it?
Oh, jeez. So,
well, how are the Braves doing?
Well, they're 6 games out of first place. They lost 2 to Washington, but they won yesterday. They play in Frisco tonight, so they're in the hunt for the wild card, and they're not totally out of the division, but. So you could have took in some Braves games over the weekend. They were right there in D.C.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I spent my time in D.C. on Sunday getting wet and picking myself up off the sidewalk.
Yeah, I read the paper today. There was about a 7 on a Richter scale. It was unexplained.
It started around 10th Street, right?
Yeah, the epicenter was right near Ford's Theater. Listen, I got to share this with y'all. Bo James called me a few minutes ago, about 30 minutes ago. And I love Bo James to death. He is so funny. He rented his ring to somebody in a little town up there outside of Bristol, Tennessee. Now they're running a NASCAR race at Bristol Saturday night. They put 100,000 people in that little stadium there, that little half-mile track that they run every August at night. Well, this guy's running the National Guard Armory. I think Bo said it was 10 or 12 miles from the racetrack. He said on Thursday nights up there, before the big race on Saturday, there's a dirt track up there that they get a bunch of the NASCAR guys to come over and run the dirt track. He said 8 miles from where he's at, he said there's 30,000 people at the racetrack. He said there's 41 in this National Guard Armory. And he said he got in there and he looked around and he said the guy didn't have no concession stand. He said he took $40 out of his pocket, ran down to the dollar store, and came back up there, and he said he set up a concession stand. He said he'd already sold out with that $40, and he was back down there when I was talking to him, loading up again. I thought, you make more money at the concession stand than you own tickets most nights.
Unbelievable. Charlie, I don't know if Charlie called you. He called me Sunday. I was on my way back from Virginia, and I talked to him, and he was saying he went somewhere Saturday night and they had six guys set up with gimmick tables. And I said, well, you had more gimmicks in the building than you had fans.
Oh. Jeez. I just,
I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they do it. I don't know why they would want to. I grew up a wrestling fan, and I enjoyed being in the wrestling business, but I didn't want to do it for free.
These guys will. Oh, yes, sir. Now, when I first got started, I worked a lot of nights for free. Because Charlie would say, always bring you stuff. I'm going to let you referee a match or two. And I'd wind up refereeing over half the card, and he'd be halfway home. And he was getting the money. But I was doing that to learn. And I was so eager to be in the business, I would have worked for free at that point. But then I realized it was a job. And I don't know. Well, I had a guy tell me one time, he was running some shows here in Georgia, and I'd went to one of his shows. And I asked him, I said, have you got enough people here to make any money? And he told me, he says, I don't do this to make money. And I said, then why are you doing it? He said, I just like being in the wrestling business. And I said, son, I said, the key word there is business. And nobody goes in a business to lose money. I don't know. Oh, well. I've tried to convince Charlie Smith to be a promoter and go back and run some shows, but he just won't go for it.
He'd make money doing it.
You can bet he would. You can bet he would.
Well, before we get too far into our show, I just want to ask everybody to keep their fingers crossed and lift up prayers to all the people along the Gulf Coast, because that looks where it's like that's where whatever the latest storm is headed. Like it might hit between Mobile and Destin between sometime late Monday night, early Tuesday morning. And my family's in Mobile, and we all have a lot of friends down around that area between Mobile and Pensacola and Fort Walton and everything. So let's hope it fizzles out, but I just have a feeling once it crosses over Florida and hits that warm Gulf water, it's going to refill the stream.
There's another one behind that one.
Just
my luck. I'll finish up here in 2 weeks, and that's probably where I'm going.
But I don't know for sure where I'm going. But it's about that
who's
time
coming
here
to Hampton? Have you heard yet?
Don't know. Bill Dundee's in Watkinsville. Not sure about Hampton. I think so. It may be Bill Carter, one of our other guys. He finished up in New Jersey Sunday, and that would have fallen right in line for him to go to. He probably went to Augusta or Hampton. I'm not sure. But I don't think it's going to be me because there'll be three others finish up before I do. They're already starting to fill in Georgia. Then one of those three, one of those guys is going to Myrtle Beach, which is before Augusta. So I think he's already there. I think he went yesterday. So that leaves one other person.
Where's Junior at?
Two other people. Junior's in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. He's got shows. I think he's got the shows coming up here sometime over the weekend, and next week he's got Thoroughfare, New Jersey. So that's another one. He'll finish up before I do. Because Ron's got the town ahead of me, then they come to me, and then they go back to Ron in Virginia. He's doing Centerville and Ashburn, Virginia. So I'm not sure who's going where or what. Ron and I are kind of hoping we get down to New Orleans again together. They're one of the swamp people, and I'm going to get them to come out to the show and bring a dead alligator.
Oh,
we get somebody to play Tuffy Truesdale.
That's like how you could wrestle it. Oh, jeez.
Oh, man. But, anyway, we are going to be joined here shortly by our special guest, Scott Teal, and he has promised another special guest, a surprise guest, and I'm anxious to see who it is.
I heard it's Hackensmith.
It's who?
Hackensmith.
I was thinking Nick Doulas myself.
Well, I was thinking Gorgeous George is going to pull a Flash Monroe and make a comeback. It'd all be a rib.
Oh, I would give anything for that to be the case.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Flash didn't, his comeback didn't last very long because
he passed
6 months after he reappeared.
Yeah, you heard that story, didn't you, Jerry?
Tell me the story, the real story.
They told everybody at the reunion he had died.
Right.
The next year he was at the reunion. And then 6 months or 8 months after the reunion, he actually did die. But he did make a brief comeback.
I heard he got killed in a car. Is that true?
No, I don't think so.
I think he had a heart attack, didn't he?
It was a heart attack, I think.
Yeah.
Where was he living?
He was living in Miami. He was living in Miami with his brother when he passed away.
How long ago was that?
I don't think his brother's alive any longer either. Tony Santos Jr. Tony Sandoval Jr. I think he's gone too. You knew Flash was Tony Santos' son, didn't you, Jerry?
Right, right. How long has Flash been gone now?
10 years or more.
Right? How many reunions have we had, Michael?
Well, didn't we just have our 21st?
Okay. Well, I missed the first two, so it's probably been 19 years ago, because he made the comeback the year before I went.
Okay.
He's been dead that long?
It's been 18, 19 years. Yeah.
My God. Couldn't have been that old either.
I'm not sure how old he was.
How old he was.
I sat in my study Sunday at church. I got a picture hanging on a wall in my study at church of me and Ted Allen, and Sunday was the second anniversary of Ted leaving us. I know for those of us that knew him, it's been a long 2 years, but in retrospect, it seems like all that's real fresh in my mind is happening yesterday.
Well, it was such a shock, I think.
That's a...
How long was it between him passing away and Rocket passing away, Bobby?
Oh, not long. Rocket, God, I don't even know. I don't know what the day was, Michael.
I want to say it was about 4 or 5
I know months. It was a Monday morning is all I can remember because it was a bad Monday.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I'm going to take a quick commercial break real quick before Scott calls in, and hopefully he'll call in shortly after and we'll get him on the line. So let's pay a bill or two. Let's see
all right.
Is Rachel from the Empire allows.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Champions of Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling
at the Academy Theater in Avondale State.
We're also at the Masquerade every month or so.
Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling.
And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire.
Formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
Back with Peace State Pandemonium, and we are joined on the line by the fabulous Scott Teal, owner, operator, chief bottle washer of Crowbar Press. What's going on, Scott?
Hi, Mike. How are you? Do I sound okay on the speakerphone?
Yeah, you should be okay.
Do I sound okay on this?
Yeah, it's breaking up a little bit, but we'll see how it goes.
You don't sound any worse than you normally do.
I'm going to get on the – I left my Bluetooth at work. Of all days, leave it at work. I hate holding this phone, but I'm going to do that. That speaker just doesn't sound as good. How are y'all doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Good. Hi, Jerry. Miss you. How are you doing?
Doing good, Scott.
Sure missed you the past couple weeks, Bobby.
Let me add a disclaimer here before we get started. If you hear children screaming in the background, it's not coming from my room.
Say what now? Say that again.
I said if you hear children screaming in the background, from me, it's not coming from me. There's a family that lives in the hotel room next door to me. It's a man and a woman and three kids, and these kids run up and down the hall all night long and all day long screaming.
Oh, my goodness.
That's not the worst part. They cook all day long, and evidently they must love fish.
Go over and ask them to share.
Because the vent blows into my room, and so my room smells like cat food all day long.
Oh, my.
I just got a text message from Bo James. He said he's shocked. 150 people, and he's making his third trip to the store. He's gonna make more money on the concession stand than he is working.
Oh my goodness! That's the way a lot of them used to do. They didn't make it on the wrestling tickets.
Well, I don't know if you heard the beginning of the show or not. He called me. He was at some show there outside of Bristol, Tennessee, and the guy didn't have a concession stand set up, so he ran to the dollar store and set his own up.
Now, losing,
you got somebody to cover for him while he goes and works his match? Or is he going to work his match in a concession stand?
Well, he told me he may not work it.
Well, Mike, give me just a minute and let me get this guy on the line, okay?
Okay, not a problem.
Hang on. Michael Norris.
Yes, sir.
Mike Norris?
Yes.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. You're the special guest.
I'm the special guest.
Yes, sir. We're going to interview you. I know all the people that listen to this show have heard you week after week after week but nobody has ever had sat down and done an interview with you and an in-depth interview and talked to you about your career, and I thought we just might do that tonight. So you are the special surprise guest. I guess you noticed the surprise in my emails.
So well, let me ask, what are we going to do the rest of the hour 45 minutes after you're talking about my career? That's about
well, you know, it's funny. I've been interviewing guys for the past 16 years for like my Whatever Happened To books and my other books, and I have people write all the time and tell me that the guys that were worked underneath were some of the most interesting stories of any of them, because those were the guys a lot of times, you know, that were on the road more, or they, you know, they were piling three and four to a car, and just more things usually went on with them. And so it doesn't matter where your standing was in the business, you know, everybody has most of the guys have really good stories. But let's start out when you were and Jerry and Bobby, you chime in where you want. Let's go before wrestling and just tell us a little bit about, Mike, where you were born and a little bit about your childhood.
I was born in Pensacola, Florida. Never lived there, but I was born there. I grew up a military brat. My father was a sergeant in the U.S. Army. He was stationed at the time of my birth. They were living in Killeen State, Killeen, Texas. My father was stationed at Fort Hood. He was a drill sergeant at Fort Hood. And my grandparents on my mother's side lived in Mobile. My grandparents on my father's side lived in Pensacola. So we were home visiting my grandparents in Pensacola when I made my debut. And if I'd have held out a couple more weeks, I'd have been a Texan. But I'm glad I picked Florida instead. I never lived there. I spent a lot of summers with my grandparents there in Pensacola. And once I got to be a teenager, I spent a lot of time in Tampa. I spent nearly every summer for about 6 years living in Tampa during the summer. And then I would go back to Mobile. From Texas, when I was about, I don't know, 6, 8 months old, we went to Boussac, France. And we actually sailed across the ocean on an ocean liner. And so before I was a year old, I crossed the ocean on an ocean liner. And we lived in
cool.
France for 2 years and came back to the States. My father got stationed at Fort Benning in Columbus. And I lived in Columbus from 1963 to July of 1968 when we went to Mannheim, Germany for 8 months. And then it's funny, I lived on Floyd Road in Columbus, Georgia, and there was a guy, and I still haven't pinned down who it was. There was a guy that lived across the street from us that worked for Fred Ward Promotion in some way, because he would take my brother and I to the wrestling match. And I was in the second grade with a kid by the name of Gary Hines, whose father was Bad Boy Hines.
Oh, cool.
So I would go over to their house, you know. And that was, you know, that was all I knew of wrestling until we came home from Germany. I was a little older. And my grandfather, came back and settled in Mobile while my father was doing his second tour of Vietnam. And we lived across the street from my grandfather. My grandfather was the biggest wrestling fan in the world. And Lee Fields was his hero. He used to go to the matches in Mobile, you know, in the 40s and 50s and everything. And he carried me to my first live wrestling show in May of 1971 to see the main event of Lee Fields versus Bobby Sane. And I was hooked. And big fan. And got to where close to the end of Lee Fields' promotion, I would help them put up the ring, do stuff, you know, run around the arena, carry jackets for the guys, you know, do stuff like that, hoping to one day get in the business, because I was fortunate enough, I had the size and had the desire, and it took me several stops and starts to get in, and I never really did work full time. I had my first match in 1979 for a little outlaw group that was running opposition to Ron Fuller, because by that, you know, Fuller bought out the Lee Fields territory in the end of 77 and reopened in March of 78 under Southeastern. And,
let's go back a little bit. We'll be done here in a minute. let me go back to your a friend, the neighbor, was it in Columbus that took you to your first wrestling match?
Yes. He lived across the street from us on Floyd Road, and I have for years I thought it was Fred Ward, but this guy was not married. He was a bachelor, and he lived in a house with two dogs. And I don't know if he was a worker, if he was a referee. I've never been able to pin down who it was, but for years I thought it was Fred Ward until I started talking to Jerry and realized that it wasn't, because Fred was married and everything. But I still don't know who this guy was.
Do you remember who was on the card that night?
The first time I went was actually a TV tape. I never went to the live matches in Columbus on the nights that they did. This guy always took us to the TV tape. He took my brother more than me. I went once or twice. But the ones I remember Billy Hines and Don Carson, and they had just done a deal in a fish restaurant or something in Columbus.
The Capri Restaurant.
What's that, Derek?
It was the Capri Restaurant.
Okay. Yeah, they had worked had a fight in that restaurant.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And so I went to the TV, and they I don't know if they worked against each other, if they just fought in the ring or whatever, but I remember Carson, I remember Billy Hines being on the card. And that was really all I remember.
You know, a lot of times when the guys back then, it wasn't anything they planned to do as far as going into the restaurant and having a fight. A lot of times if they wound up in the same place, they'd do it because people just didn't think they could sit there in the same building without getting upset with each other and fighting, you know. Right. So they'd just go into it, and then it would lead into a publicity. That was good memory, Jerry. I'd never heard that story before. Did you remember?
They took them both to jail.
Uh-huh.
I remember. That's where I got in the business, but I remember because I was going to the matches thing, and I remember that well.
Wow. That's cool.
I don't remember if I saw it on TV or if I just remember hearing the stories and reading about it. I know it was in the Columbus paper, but I don't even remember what year it was. Mario Galento, and again, this involved Billy Hines. I think Billy may have been booking for Fred at that time. But he and Mario Galento were working on television before Fred's TV was always live. And they did a deal where Mario hit Hines in the head with a roll of dimes or quarters or whatever in his hand. Of course, coins went everywhere. Well, either the Muskogee County Sheriff or the Chief of Police for Columbus, whoever it was watching it on TV, and Steve Pompey got in his car and went down there and arrested Mario on television.
Oh, my. That's hilarious. What year were you born?
1959.
Okay. And so would you have been around 5 years old?
Yeah, 4 or 5, because somewhere like that, yeah. Because I don't remember how long we've been living in Columbus. I had to be about 5, because when we first came back from France, we rented a house in another neighborhood before we bought the house on Floyd Road.
Yeah.
And that's the guy that carried us to the matches lived across the street from us on Floyd Road.
Yeah, because in 1964, in March, Carson and Hines were both in Columbus. In fact, they on March 25th, there was a time when Fred Ward quit using talent from the Georgia office, and that card on the night, which it could have been, it was March 25th, 64. You said it was TV, but during that, it may have been that week, the TV for that show, that was the first card Fred Ward ran after he resumed using the talent from the Georgia office. I guess they got back together and settled their differences. But Joe Scarpa was there, Buddy Fuller. Do you remember at Crusher Verdue?
No, I don't. Like I said, Doug, and I guess the only reason they stick out in my mind is because after I came back to Mobile and was living in Mobile, Carson was a big baby face in Mobile, and the Hines brothers
were
in and out. I remembered them from that point, and of course I knew more about Bad Boy because I went having gone to the second grade with Gary, his son.
Yes. Yeah. Was that your neighbor took you to that card? Was that your very first realization that there was such a thing as wrestling, or had you seen it?
Absolutely. I've never even seen it on TV.
Uh-huh.
Never even seen it on TV. I couldn't even tell you what channel it came on. Three channels back in those days. I don't even know.
It didn't have many.
What station he ran on?
It was Channel 9.
I know when I was working for him in the 70s, it was on 4.
That's right, it was CBS.
RBL.
Yeah, they switched it, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you become a real fan after that, Mike, and sort of followed
him really,
on TV?
Not really, I really didn't become a big into it. I mean, I knew who the guys were, and, you know, I, because the kids at school would talk about it, especially when Gary was around, because he had something to brag about. I would hear, and I would know who they were talking about, but it wasn't one of those things like it became when I lived in Mobile, where it was, you know, I had to watch it every time, you know, every Saturday night. It was a given thing. It was not that way. I guess because I was so young and I was so, you know, I was only 4, 5, 6, whatever age I was. And then my brother was older. My brother was 4 years older than me, so he was more into it than I was.
Yeah.
He went more often with the TV matches. I only went, like I said, 1 or 2 times. And, I wasn't into it. I didn't really become a big-time mark until Mobile.
Yeah. Moving up a little bit, with your friend Gary, do you remember him having any problems with friends at school because his dad was a wrestler? Not only that, but that his dad was a heel that everybody really hated.
Actually, the Hines were baby faces in Columbus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, from the time I remember. This was a couple of years difference from when I first went. Because I would have been in the second grade in 66.
Uh-huh.
So I'm pretty sure the Hines brothers were working babyface at that point. But, no, I don't ever remember any problems, anything like that. He was more like a mini celebrity than anything else.
Kids in school, a lot of times they took a lot of heat from the friends. Everybody challenged them to fight and everything, you know, because they got teased. You know, their dad's a wrestler. You ought to be tough, too. And
right. I don't remember anything like that. I was only around him that 1 year.
Yeah. Did you get to meet his dad at the time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I went to their house because they lived over off of, help me out, Gary. What was when you went up Floyd Road going towards, there used to be that clay, big clay pit. There's an apartment complex now.
Yeah, I know where they live. I can't.
What is that highway there? Is it Atlanta Highway?
No.
Not, is it Buena Vista?
Well, Buena Vista Road's on one end of Floyd Road, and the other end is, God, what is that road on the other end? Because the other end of that road was the road Ted lived on Snelling when that was off that road.
Exactly.
But I don't remember what the road name was on the other end.
That may have been because that's where Hines lived. He lived, if you went out past that big, what used to be a big dirt clay pit out near Wesley Heights Elementary School, which is where we went.
Yeah.
You're talking about Chautauqua Road.
That's where, what is it?
Chautauqua Road.
Could be. I don't remember. I used to walk there all the time.
Chautauqua Road, is that the one, Jerry, out there where the prison farm and all that stuff is?
Yeah,
okay.
Well, that creek that you and, where is that creek that you and Dickie had that car wreck in?
On Macon Road, going out Macon Road.
Macon Road, that's where
it is. Bull Creek.
Bull Creek, yeah.
Okay, it was out that way. It was out close to the Wesley Heights.
Yeah, that was, you said 67, and I looked that up in my records here, and I just never thought of the Hind boys being baby faces, but of course, Billy, yeah, they were both in there, but yeah, they worked with El Mongo, Bobby Graham, Gene Anderson, Lars Anderson.
Yeah, they were over there.
I guess Jerry, yeah, it's just hard to picture them as baby faces.
Billy,
what other
as a baby face in Mobile than he did at Hill, especially during his peak time in the 60s. Because he, you know, he feuded with the original Rocket Monroe, all kinds of people like that. He was more over. And I think, like I said, a lot of times that may be when he was booking, when he booked himself as a face at Hill.
When did the wrestling bug actually kick in?
1970. We came home from Germany. Like I said, my father went with for his second tour of Vietnam. We rented a house that wasn't far from my grandparents, and then we built one. When my father came back, we built one right across the street from my grandparents. My grandfather was dyed-in-the-wool wrestling fan, and I would go over to his house and spend the night at his house on Saturday night so I could watch, you know, wrestling at 10 o'clock on Saturday night from Channel 3. And that's when it really hit me. And it was, you know, it was rule. And, of course, people won't associate or find this relative. But I grew up in a house with only one TV, black and white TV. And so, you know, I had to fight to get the TV, because not only with my brother, but with my parents, too. And I pitched enough of a fit where everybody realized at 10 o'clock on Saturday night, everybody had to go find something to do. TV was mine. And then I figured out that if I went outside after that show was over with and turned the antenna, and we had the big antenna on the side of the house, if I turned it just a certain way, I could pick up Channel 13 out of Biloxi and see the same guy, a different show, but the same guys working out of well, it was taped in Hattiesburg, but they ran it on Biloxi Television.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so that's 30 minutes of that show. So I was a real big time. And then if I couldn't, I wouldn't. Somewhere along the line, somebody gave me a tape recorder for my birthday, Christmas, or something. One of those little portable tape recorders with the microphone that plugged in. I would tape that.
Yeah.
And what I wouldn't give to have all those audio tapes that I had back in those days.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
Them,
it's funny.
Replay them over and over and over.
Yeah.
Relive all the angles on TV.
Yeah,
and then
especially
I started
the interviews.
Getting the newspaper clippings. Yeah. I started getting the newspaper clippings because, Scott, as you know, the Mobile paper, because Jack Bitterman was the house announcer for Lee, the Mobile. He also worked for the Press Register. And so he gave the promotion a lot of newspaper. So,
best coverage of any city in the United States.
And so I started cutting those out, and I kept a scrapbook. You know, this is all I was 11, 12 years old. And then my grandmother, I would go over to stay with her in Pensacola, and I, of course, you know, she pampered me, so she made sure that I got to watch wrestling on Saturday night. It's funny. I always associate Carol Burnett with wrestling. And the reason why is because the wrestling always, the Carol Burnett show was ran from 9 to 10 on Channel 5. And when it was over, I turned it to Channel 3 and watched wrestling. And then she started cutting the clippings out of the Pensacola paper and sending them to me. So I was a mark. I was a big mark.
That's the way most of us started. I'm sure everybody on this phone right now, or this show right now, is in the same situation. Who was the wrestler, other than Billy Hines, who was the first wrestler you actually became friends with or, you know, got to know on a first-name basis and they knew who you were?
Don Carson.
Really?
Don
Carson, tell us about
that. My aunt and uncle and two cousins lived in Pensacola. They lived in Crescent Lake.
the Crescent Lake part of Pensacola. And Don Carson lived about five houses down from my cousin. And we would walk there to go down. Crescent Lake was actually, there was a lake in the subdivision. And we would walk down to the swimming in the lake, and we would walk by his house. And sometimes he'd be out, and, you know. So by that time, I wasn't following wrestling, and I knew who he was. And so I would go up and talk to him and stuff like that. And he was very, you know, welcoming and everything. He was, you know, he took up a lot of time with us and everything. Of course, he was working as a babyface too. So, but he had that house for years. Even after he left Mobile, I think he rented it for years.
Huh. Did you stay friend? Did you become friends with him as time went on? And
not really, because he left the territory. I think he moved. He left Pensacola and moved to Cleveland, Tennessee, which is where he was from originally. I think he got out of the business for a while. I think he became a jailer or deputy sheriff or something in Tennessee for a while.
Yeah.
Then he came back. But by the time he came back, my cousin and they had all moved to Tampa. And I started going down there, so I never crossed that. The only time I crossed paths with him again was during when I was breaking into the business, when he was working for Fuller. I would talk to him, and you know, he wouldn't have known me, just me walking up. I had to tell him who I was and all that, and he remembered me, or he said he did.
Yeah.
You know, whether he actually did or not, but, you know. In fact, well, he told me then he still owned that house on Crescent Lake, but he always rented it out.
Huh. When did you actually start going to the house shows? And do you remember the first show you went to in Mobile?
The first one was the one in May of 1971. I can still tell you every card, every match that was on that card. I remember. That's the only one that I can remember, I guess, because it was my first one. But my grandfather went to Kirby back a handful of times, and my father would carry me every once in a while when I'd bug him enough. But I didn't really start going, you know, on my own until I was old enough to drive.
Uh-huh.
Then I had regular.
Who was on that first show? I'm sorry to interrupt.
The first match was a 15-minute draw between Flash Monroe and Johnny West. Johnny West, of course, was Kevin Sullivan.
Uh-huh.
Next was Frank Dalton beat Nikita Malkovich.
Was that at the Municipal Auditorium?
Yes, that was at the Municipal Auditorium. In fact, it was a sellout crowd.
Yeah, 6,000 people they had there that night.
Over 10,000 people.
That was Bobby, that night Bobby Shane's wrestled Lee Field,
exactly.
Right?
That was the night Lee came back. And that was the first night that Bobby Shane wore the crown and started calling himself.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Huh.
Prior to that, they called him Mr. Personality or the Profile. He had a dozen different names, the Wonder Boy. But that was the first night he wore the crown out.
That's interesting right there.
I know there was a tag match between Don Carson and Dick Dunn worked against Eddie Sullivan and Dandy Jack Morrell. Of course, Dandy Jack Morrell was Frank Morrell.
Yep.
I'm sure there was another singles match in there somewhere, but I can't remember.
Lucas actually worked with Flash Monroe.
Was it Lucas?
And that's the results I've got. Johnny West, Kevin Sullivan, wrestled Gentleman Jim, which is Jimmy Hyde.
Okay, you're right. It was Jimmy Hyde, yeah. And then the Pro and Boyette worked with Uta and Coma and won the United States Tag Team belts that night, but then they announced before the match, win, lose, or draw, that the Pro was suspended. And so even though they won the titles, the Pro was suspended. Boyette, that was funny because they had both been heels. And both of them had been turned on by Terry Garvin and Bobby Shane. So they kind of were like, formed a team together, but they weren't working with any other babyfaces. And then they won that
the title, and then the next week, because the pro was gone, so he, boy, it was allowed to pick a new partner, so he picked Ken Lucas, then he turned on Lucas, and they lost the title back to the Rising Suns.
Yeah.
And then the main event was Lee and Bobby Shane.
Huh. Now, normally they had wrestling at, was it Fort Whiting during that time?
Well, they ran Fort Whiting up until around, yeah, somewhere a couple months prior to that. They had worked out a deal, and Bob Kelly's told me the details of this. They were having some conflicting dates and stuff with Fort Whiting. So Bob went to the auditorium, and they were selling out Fort Whiting quite a bit too. So Bob went to the auditorium and to see what they could work out with that. The guy was telling him then that they were in the process of building the Expo Hall next door, and that eventually, you know, they would need to move into there. But until that was done, they could have every Wednesday. Mobile at that time was Wednesday nights. They could have every Wednesday night in the big auditorium for the same rent. I don't know what that rent was. But they stayed in there from, every once in a while they would go back to Fort Whiting, conflicting with the auditorium, they would go back to Fort Whiting. But for the most part, they were in that big auditorium up until early 73 is when they moved in the Expo Hall. And to me, when they moved from the auditorium into the Expo Hall, even though they still had good matches and everything, and I still went, it died. It started, I don't know, it just started going downhill. The crowds were smaller, and the guys worked just as hard. The matches were just as good, but to me, it just changed everything. And then they changed to Thursday nights, too, which was different.
Sometimes it's the ambiance of the building.
Yeah, and that was a great building.
Yeah.
Bobby can tell you, he thought he hit the big time when he walked in there until he found out he was working the Expo Hall.
Yeah. Yeah, my first night in Mobile, I got there, man, couldn't find a place to park. I thought, boy, isn't this sweet? Walked in, it was a high school graduation. The guy says, you in the little building next door. Thank you. Yeah, me and Jerry and Mike's talked about that a lot. You're talking about the ambience of the building. You know, certain buildings were just built for wrestling. You know.
Yes.
Even if you went in the building, I know the City Auditorium was like in Atlanta for me. If I walked in the auditorium and there was an ice show or a circus or anything, I mean, it was just my mind always went to wrestling because that's just what that building meant to me, you know.
Yeah.
Jerry's talked about
Fort
Augusta was that way, you know.
Fort Homer Hesterly in Tampa was like that. Of course, they didn't have other shows. Oh, absolutely. I spent so much time there. They didn't have other shows or anything there, but it was just... It was a place for wrestling and nothing else.
My wife.
There were times that I'd go in the Armory, the Hesley Armory, and they literally had standing room. Well, they were selling people tickets to stand up against the wall.
That's right.
And
that's right.
That place used to pack out.
My wife ice skated there.
It was either the.
What'd you say, Jerry? I heard you say something. I couldn't hear you.
I said my wife ice skated there in Fort Hesley. But she was a holiday on ice.
I didn't know they did other shows there. That's interesting.
I don't know what else they had there. But that was the only place they had to skate there. She was the holiday on ice. They skated there. She said they nearly burned up in that building.
That was probably before they built the Curtis Hickson Hall, I would imagine.
Right. Oh, it was, yeah. Yeah, I can't even imagine them putting ice in there, you know, and it holds.
Yeah, right.
Going back to 1971, it was either my second or third card that I went to live, again at the auditorium. I don't remember much else that was on there, but I do remember a tag team match, and it wasn't even a main event. It was about the middle of the card. A guy by the name of Walt Fayette, who I had never figured out who he was, where he came from. I've never seen his name anywhere else or any other wrestling results. He teamed with somebody, and I don't remember who it was, but they wrestled Frank Dolphin and Jerry Oates.
Oh, really?
Mobile, yep.
What was his name?
They were supposed to be they had some no-shows on that card or something, and they changed it around a little bit. I think Jerry was supposed to work a singles match. He wound up teaming with Frank Dawson.
That was a year after your dog tournament, that first match you went to, Mike. June 28th.
I was thinking that was...
No, June 28th, 72. Bob Kelly worked with Gorgeous George Jr.
Okay, it was 72 then, okay. I was thinking Jerry was in 71.
Now, that's the first show. Now, Walt Fayad's partner was Rick Rinaldo that night.
Rick Rinaldo, okay, okay. But have you ever heard of Walt Fayad?
I never heard the name, no, absolutely not.
I can tell you what he looked like, but I can't. He looked like Dale Lewis.
I think he's the cab driver. He's the cab driver that picked me up at the airport. I've never heard that name, man.
Oh, buddy.
That sounds as good as anything.
Did he ask you when you got in the ring if you knew how to work, Jerry?
Yeah.
Hey, kid, are you smart?
Yeah, I've heard that one.
That's a funny line.
How about the week after that first show you went to, Mike, Bobby Shane against Lee Fields? They came back the following week. An interesting bit of history here. Rip Tyler wrestled Cowboy Bob Kelly and won the Gulf Coast title, and that's the night they presented Kelly
the
with the new title belt.
Right.
Presented it to Tyler, I mean. Now, does Kelly still
Kelly
have that old belt?
And then lost
yes.
it.
Oh, really?
A little history about that belt. In April of 72, Don Fargo had it. And he was, he and Kelly were going through a thing, but they worked a deal where Kelly got suspended. They brought a guy that worked for Billy Golden in Montgomery by the name of Bob Caldwell. They brought him down and put him in the audience. And Kelly and Fargo at that time, all they did was beat each other. I mean, they bust each other open hard way and everything, and that was their typical match. Well, they'd been doing this for about 3 months, and they sent this guy into the ring, and Kelly punched him. And, of course, they brought it up. This guy was an NWA official, and they suspended Kelly for a week pending, a hearing they were going to have. And they ended up having it, saying they had it in Nashville. And they had one on TV, and Kelly had asked for people to, get up petitions and all this stuff to get him reinstated. Well, 13-year-old Mark, me in the sixth grade, I signed one of those petitions. But Kelly said they actually got 10,000 something signatures. But anyway, during the time that they were working this angle with Kelly suspended, they were bringing it back for a big match with him and Don Fargo. Well, Fargo quit and took that Gulf Coast belt with him. He gave it back to Ricky Fields about 15 years ago. He had it all the time.
No kidding. Wow. To about a few weeks, or actually a couple months, after that card with Lee Fields, I keep going back to your early days, Lee Fields wrestled Bobby Shane. They came back in July, where Lee Fields wrestled a masked guy, I guess, called The Stranger, with Bobby Shane as his manager. Do you know who? I never knew who that was.
I have no idea who it was.
Oh. Huh.
That's the reason he wore a mask, guys. Y'all not supposed to know who he was.
That was the cab driver.
It's a little
that was Walt Fayad.
That was Walt Fayad again.
I love it.
Well, Bobby Sandman.
Well, Mike. Yeah, that could have been. Now,
what
did you do any wrestling in high school?
What's that?
Did you do any wrestling in high school?
No, Davidson High School, where I went to high school and graduated from, we didn't have a wrestling team. They've got one now. They started it 2 years after I graduated. I would have loved to have gotten done amateur wrestling.
What year did you graduate?
1977.
Okay. Uh-huh. What did you do after you graduated high school?
I started working pretty much full-time retail when I was in junior high school. I was working a full-time job my senior year of high school because I was in a work release. Sounds like I was in prison. But we had a work release program where if you had a job, you got out of school, you only took two classes a day and you got out of school at like noon or something like that. So I started working in a warehouse for a little small department store, and I was the tour department sales manager during Christmas. And then when we only opened up a toy store or a tour department during Christmas, after that we shut it back down and I worked in the warehouse again. But I did that, and then when I graduated from high school, I went to work at another store and was the assistant tour department sales manager. And then I went to Mobile College, which is now called the University of Mobile. I went there for about three semesters and then dropped out and went to trade school and took graphic arts in trade school. And dropped out of that. And then I moved to Birmingham in 1981. And I had been wrestling off and on the little outlaw promotion in Pensacola. I started doing that in 79. Don Fargo helped me get in. Rick Tyler was booking it. It was a group that was owned by a gentleman by the name of Doyle Wiggins, and it was called Tri-States, and they just ran BFW halls and stuff like that. They were working in Pensacola, down around Panama City, over Valparaiso, places like that, and I worked two or three matches for them, basically just learning, opening matches, doing squashes. But I was around Rocket Monroe. Rocket worked for him. Armand Hussein. Guy by the name of Lord John Raven. Of course, Rip was there. Eddie Sullivan was there. Greg Peterson was there. Dick Dunn was there. A lot of the old the Gulf Coast guys that Ron Fuller wouldn't use, they worked doing this, this little outlaw thing. I worked a handful of matches with them, and then the guy that was training me was a friend of Fargo's, a guy by the name of Mike Diamond.
Yeah.
He was training me. Well, I had started, prior to that, I had started finally pinned down somebody. I asked everybody I could to help me get in the business. The only one that even gave me any kind of time was Norvell Austin. Norvell helped me out some, and I worked out with him some. And then he got sent to Knoxville. At that time, Fuller on both, Mobile and Knoxville. He got sent to Knoxville. So when he left, I was pretty much back to square one. Well, just out of the blue, on a Sunday afternoon, I'll never forget it, I was at my girlfriend's house. I got mother called me over there at my girlfriend's house and said, "You got a phone call. This guy wants you to call me." And I said, "Who was it?" She said, "Don Fargo." And I'm like, "Huh? I hadn't even talked to Fargo. I don't know how he got my name, my phone number, anything. But he had called my house and wanted me to call him. So I called him, and he said, "Be in Pensacola tomorrow at this address and meet with a guy named Mike Diamond." Okay. So I worked out with Mike Diamond, and he got me booked with this outlaw group. He used to work out on the Naval Air Station in Pensacola because one of the guys that was also working with them was a company commander, and he had access to the base. So we would go over there, and we worked out in a boxing ring, which was horrible. I wanted to be in the business of that. But after about 6 weeks, I show up. I did this every Sunday. I would go to Mike Diamond's house, we'd work out or whatever. And if they had something booked, he would help me, get booked on a show or whatever. But after about 6 weeks, I went over there and he was gone, lock, stock, and barrel.
Huh.
So there again, I'm back to square one.
My goodness. Hey, go back a little bit to the that first promotion you worked for. Now, how did it come about that you got
you know, noticed, or did they, you know, to train with them or to work with them?
Mike Simon and Fargo were both working for this promotion. And basically, Mike Diamond, you know, he was providing, you know, some of the guys that worked out with us. He can't be company commander. He worked under a hood because obviously he was, you know, in the military, so he couldn't let run the risk of somebody finding out what he was moonlighting. But he worked under a hood. You know, they would use me in an opening match or something like that. But that's how. You know, you know how outlaw shows are. Basically, you just hope for enough people to show up to put on shows. Well, I was one of those guys that showed up.
So they, even with all those the legends like, you know, Rip Tyler and Eddie and they didn't do that well.
They didn't work all the time. Most of them, they just did it as, I mean, by that time Rip had his own appliance store. He was also selling insurance. Duke Dunn was selling insurance. Greg Peterson had his locksmith business in Bonifay. Eddie was in the process of either going to Tennessee or going back to Phoenix. I don't remember which. Armand Hussein was there only a handful of times. And the rest, you know, it was all just part-time work for them, basically. I think Terry Latham was around then, too. Seems like he and Ricky Field were in and out of there, too, for Doyle.
Yeah.
But,
wow, that's a lot of talent. A lot of good.
They didn't have set, you know, set nights like a regular territory. It was just whenever you could, you know, get a building and pull people together.
And it's hard to get buildings too because the main promotion usually had people blocked out of the good buildings or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, he was trying to run against Fuller.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of that was generated by Rip Tyler. Rip Tyler had started out working for Fuller when Fuller came and started down there. He and Eddie were both working for him. And Rip had a falling out with either Fuller or Bob Armstrong. I don't remember what it was, but he pretty much quit. And I think he found Doyle, and Doyle found him, and they just decided to try and run opposition.
Yeah. That was a time past the time. I mean, before that, if you ran opposition, you could get your legs broke or, you know, the guys would show up. But that was really past the time where that thing was any kind of a big deal at all.
I think Ron knew enough that we weren't pulling enough away from him, like I said, because it wasn't like we had a set time to where we could build a fan base. I say we. I wasn't really a part of that promotion. But even though you know, that group in one way or another lasted because from, I think, Tri-States ran from 79 through 80, 81, and then a couple of years later, Grady Owen?
Oh, yeah.
He came in and ran a group called All-Star. Used a lot of the same guys, Dick Dunn, Mike Boyette, Terry Latham, and then All-Star kind of faded away. And a couple of years later, Rip opened WOW and used a lot of the same guys. So, I mean, there was a lot of local guys around Pensacola that you could always, you know, throw together something. WOW was the strongest because by that time it started running. I don't even think Fuller was running Pensacola anymore or Mobile. He had pretty much gone back up towards Birmingham, the north part of Alabama, and then back into Knoxville.
Yeah. What was going back again? You mentioned carrying jackets and doing that. What was the first actual thing you actually did at an arena there in Mobile where you were actually doing something for somebody?
I hope I don't get heat over this, but I tell people all the time, my first job in the wrestling business was meeting Mike Boyette at the back door of the Expo Hall with a cup of coffee to sober him up. Because Mike at that time was living in Pensacola, and he would kind of get loopy coming from Pensacola to Mobile. And so I
Field would have me meet him at the back door with a cup of coffee. And from that, you know, I was dating a girl that went to the matches with me all the time. And she was as big a fan as I was. And we would, you know, the guys would trust us to give us their jacket. You know, we had ringside seats. So they would call us over to hold their jacket. Because, you know, there was always kids around wanting to hold their jackets or something like that. They'd always call one or the other of us over there to do that. And so it just became a regular thing. And we got to be like many celebrities. I had people from other audience members would come up to me and say, my little girl wants to meet so-and-so. Can you introduce us to so-and-so? I'm like, you know, so I got the big head. And,
so you're a pimp.
Yeah. Wow. Now, it's funny because later on, after Fuller started running, this had been 80 or so, and I had a handful of matches, but I was, again, in between. But because the way I wore my hair, I had a mustache. Everybody in the audience thought I was Jimmy Golden. I would come into the arena and start going to my seat, and people would start yelling things at me because they thought I was Jimmy Golden.
Oh.
And so I was trying to get in the business because I wanted to see if I couldn't, you know, become a work brother, because people, you know, automatically hated me because they thought I was Jimmy Golden. I thought, well,
yeah. Nothing came of it, though, huh?
No.
What other jobs, who paid you to do stuff like wait at the back door for a boy and that kind of thing?
Oh, I didn't get paid for that. I just did that as something. You know, I was just trying to get attention, trying to get enough, you know, get somebody to feel comfortable with me. And I
just
was told later on, pretty much. And I never asked about, you know, whether or not none of that ever came to my mind, you know, asking if it was fixed or anything like that. I never knew, you know, people think it's a cliche and people think it's BS and stuff, but I didn't know until basically I worked my first match that it was, you know, work. I mean, I picked up on stuff as I was trained. Okay, here's how you do this spot, here's how you do this spot, you know, but nobody ever sat me down and said, you know, it's a work until basically I had my first match.
Huh. Yeah, they used to not do that because they didn't want, otherwise so many people used to try out or learn.
I was lucky. I mean, I worked with guys who probably could have stretched me, but I was respectful enough, and enough people had seen me around and knew that, you know, I wasn't some loudmouth saying, you know, I can beat anybody and all that stuff, but I was respectful to the business, and they knew I had the desire to be in it. So I didn't get stressed. I got, you know, other than, you know, my face rubbed in the mat and having to run the ropes for 25 minutes till I collapsed and stuff like that. Nobody tried to discourage me from breaking in the business. Well, I take it back. Rocky McGuire did, but he did it because he just didn't think that the wrestling business was what I was making it out to be. And it turned out that it wasn't. But you know, he took me to lunch one time and he was telling me, look, you don't want to get in this business. He wouldn't come out and say what it was about or anything like that. He said, it's just not a bit, because, you know, I was at that time, I was engaged to get married and everything. And, you know, and he tried to discourage me. Ricky Fields tried to discourage me, but I wasn't having it. I was going to be in the business one way or the other.
You got the bug. You're going to do
it. Absolutely.
Jerry, do you have any questions, or Bobby, about this time in his career?
Why didn't you pursue it further than what you did, Mike?
Because I saw, basically, after nearly 3 years of start and stop, I saw the path that I was going to go down. I was going to be a job guy on TBS. That was all I was going to be. Or wherever else Mike Jackson could give me a book at the time. And, you know, because that was, you know, the role that was assigned to me. And to be honest with you, I wasn't that good. I was awkward. You know, I was so tall and
and awkward. I couldn't keep my weight up. I didn't think I'd ever be any better than I was, and I didn't want to just do jobs on TV.
That never stopped Jerry. He went on to have a pretty good career.
That's right.
Good one.
You know, I mean, it's perseverance. That's you know, I mean, that's something nobody understands, I don't think, anymore. I don't think the guys today or even the average fan that wasn't a fan back then understands just how hard it was to get in this business back then.
Absolutely, that's right.
I mean, it was not. I mean, there wasn't any schools. I mean, you know, and if they were, they would have laughed at you if you told them you went. You know, it's sort of like, I guess, going to the radio station and tell them you went to the Columbia School of Broadcasting. You know, I mean, they just you had to know somebody, or you had to be fortunate enough to be at the right place at the right time, like I was, and somebody just happened to like you and see you as a kid that just had a dream and helped you. And that's yep.
Well, a lot of guys come along too late.
Oh yeah,
you
know, started changing so drastically.
Well, I think that was a lot because my dream, I always wanted to work for the field of promotion, and that was my dream. And I think had I broken in at the time that they were, I'd have probably done better. I don't know if I would have money-wise, but career-wise, I'd have probably, because it was a much smaller group of people, and, you know, they didn't have the need for, you know, somebody just to put over somebody else on TV, which was the role I ended up in. At least I like to tell myself that I may have done better there. And even though Ron Fuller kept us, the only full-time I ever worked in the business, I worked for Ron Fuller for 3 weeks as Mr. Junior America. And there again, I was opening mats, but I was at least working every night. And the pay was okay. I got $45 a night. And I actually got my money, and I didn't have to split three-quarters of it with somebody who got me booked. And which is another story. But
we'll get into that one. That's a good story. That's something I was going to ask a little while later, but go ahead and tell about that.
Well, I mean, basically...
That did happen a lot.
Yeah, well, basically, after all my stops and starts in the summer of 81, the girl I had been engaged to, we had actually broken up in February of that year. And I was still hanging around the wrestling matches in... in kind of a roundabout way, I become friends with Jerry Stubbs. I was still trying to do whatever I could to get my foot in the door, even though I had worked a handful of matches, you know, basically. Well, I'm not going to tell them, I worked for the opposition. As much as Tri-State was opposition, yeah. But I was still trying to do whatever I could. And Fargo was back working for Fuller. And I remembered, or I came across or something, I was going through my scrapbook, and I remembered that Fargo, back in the early 70s, he had done a book, and I know you guys, well, Jerry, I don't know if you've seen it, but Bobby, you've seen it, Scott, you've seen it, because they used to sell them at the reunion in Mobile. They had a book where they had autographed pictures on one side, and on the opposite side of it, Fargo had drawn a caricature of that particular wrestler.
Yeah.
I took art all through school. I was a cartoonist. So I thought, I went to Stubbs. I said, you know, I can do that. Why don't you, why don't we go in together? I'll do all the artwork and everything. You pay to have it printed up. We'll sell it and split the money. And he said, well, I'll have to go to the Welch's first. You know, because they had to approve everything. So he went to it and talked to Roy Lee Welch about it. Roy Lee said, yeah, that's fine, let's do it. So had them printed up and everything. 3 weeks go by, and I'm every Tuesday night, I'm in Mobile, I'm seeing these books all over the place. Everybody's got one. Well, I haven't seen a dime yet. I went to Roy Lee Welch, and I said, I'm not going to get paid for my books. You know, everybody's got one. Well, we're having to give them away. They're not selling.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, well, here I am. I'm in a quandary now because I'm still trying to get, you know, in the wrestling business. This is the local promoter. Well, Roy Lee was tied in with, and I knew that. So what do I do? Raise a fuss, keep my mouth shut, and even though I look stupid, maybe they'll think, you know, he's okay, and they'll help me get the business. Well, in the meantime, during that time frame, Jerry had won the World Junior Heavyweight Championship from Les Thornton and lost it back a week later. But I had done a portrait of him with the belt, and I just did it out of friendship. And in the meantime, everybody wanted one. Archie Goldie wanted one. Spike wanted one. So I did him up one, and carried him in, and Don Carson took it back and never came out with my money. I was just, beside the mark, I was a fish, too. But anyway, I found out later on when I was working for Fuller, I went to lunch with Larry Brock, and first time I did Dope and TV, he and Jackson and I went to lunch, and we were talking about it. And somehow the reason of the subject of that book came up that I'd done. And, I mean, they had it on TV. They were showing it on TV. Charlie Platt was talking about it. And Larry said, yeah, that thing sold like crazy.
Oh,
and
my.
And I said, you know who did that, don't you, who drew that book? And he said, Roy Lee was having us announce at the matches that it was a little crippled boy in a wheelchair that needed trying to raise money for an operation. So, well, that was
something. Oh, my. Oh, my. Unbelievable. And people talk about Nick Gulas.
Yeah. Well, you know, all is well.
Well, as good as that is.
The first reunion I went to, and Bob Boyer pulled me aside and said, well, now you know where the term being welch comes from.
Well, as good as that is, it doesn't beat Chico selling Tex Riley's dog.
Yes.
Auctioning it off.
That's funny.
But then, anyway, Jerry got me. He knew I was moving to Birmingham. I left Mobile and moved to Birmingham. I went up there to work for my uncle who had his own law firm. And he said, well, if you're going to Birmingham, I'll hook you up with Mike Jackson. So Mike Jackson, you know, I worked out with him 2 or 3 weeks, and he started getting me books on TV. And, you know, a little, either a house show that somebody was doing for the fire or something, a lot of the little outlaw groups he did.
Yeah.
But, of course, every promotion, with the exception of when I did Atlanta TV, everybody paid cash. They paid Jackson, you know, my money.
Yeah.
What was the guarantee back then, Bobby, for Georgia?
House shows were $65.
Yeah, I would get 30.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
The only time I got my actual money is because they sent a check. If you did Atlanta TV, you got a check.
Goodness.
It was $50 if you did the first hour, and it was $75 if you did both hours.
There again, you were in a bad spot because it's same as the books. You know, you would like to have complained to whoever, you know, Mike or whoever, and find out who it was, but then you're worried about you're going to cut off your nose, bite your face, and they're never going to use
exactly.
you again.
Exactly. So, and I was told, I mean, a lot of the guys, and Jackson told me when, you know, the first trip we made over to Atlanta to do TV, he said, you'll do good in this business. I said, why? He said, because if you've been around me for, at this point, I think it was a month, he said, you've never asked me if the business is real or not. I said, well, you know. It was always real to me. You shut up and learn. I mean, you just
that's
you
right.
shut up and speak when you're spoken to. And
right.
I remember the first time I did Atlanta TV, I walked in, Ole was booking. You know how you spend enough time around Ole, you know what his personality is like.
What do you mean?
Jackson introduced me to him, and I think I was working with Snooker or something. So Ole said, go get me your boots. See what this is about. So I walked over and got my boots, brought them over to him, and handed him one of them. He
turned it upside down and looked at the soles of it. He said, "You're another one of Mike Jackson's wannabes, huh?"
Oh, no.
Whatever. But anyway, I found out he never would tell me, but I found out later he liked me enough where he wanted to keep using it. The first time I did a house show in Georgia, I went to Chattanooga, and I wasn't booked to work. I wasn't supposed to work. I Donald and Dumb TV with Jackson and a guy named Phil Peanut Strickland and his stepson, Barry Cummins, who worked. They were from, what was the name of it? It was a little town with a guy there that ran it. Called himself the promoter. He did not say promoter. He said promoter, which was fitting because of what his shows were like. What was the name of that town? Fayette, Alabama. But anyway, the four of us had gone over and done TV, and I was driving them up to Chattanooga. Phil and Mike were booked against each other on the opening match. So I'm in the Hill. Dressing room, Phil and I are sitting there, and I'm just sitting here. You know, I've got my bag with me, but I'm not getting dressed or anything. Ole walks in and says, "Who's Strickland?" Peanut raised his hand and said, "I am." He looked at him and said, "Not tonight, you're not." He pointed at me and said, get dressed. You're Phil Strickland tonight." So that was the first time I ever worked a house show. I was introduced as Phil Strickland. I worked as Phil Strickland.
That's hilarious. That's too funny. What did your parents think about your, I know your father was a big fan. Were they pretty excited?
Well, actually, my father wasn't a big fan. I mean, he gave in to me and was carrying him. My grandfather was a big fan. Unfortunately, by the time I finally got in the business, he had had a series of strokes, and his health was not well. He died not long after that. My other grandfather, the one that lived in Pensacola, he was the only one that ever saw me on TV. He saw me the first time I did Dothan TV. I worked against Norvell. And he saw me on there, and unfortunately, the way my family was, he was disgusted because I was in there with a black man. So, you know, it is what it is. My friends, all the ones that I kept, because I moved to Birmingham, and I was not planning on going back to Mobile because I didn't like Mobile. I didn't like living there. Never cared for Mobile. My dream was to get away from there. And I planned on staying in Birmingham and eventually moving to Atlanta, which I did. But my career was what brief bit of it was. By the time I moved to Atlanta, I worked one match and then decided to quit because I had started working a full-time job and started going to school. And my plan was to finish school and then still work on the weekend, wrestle on the weekend, because I was living in Atlanta. I figured I could do Atlanta TV. But I ended up working every weekend just about. So. And then by the time it settled down after I got out of school and thought I could do everything, I'd lost all my contacts. But I was getting calls. Jackson would call me all the time to come work. I just couldn't. Ricky Fields told me one time that the business was like mafia. It was hard to break into, and it was even harder to quit once you got in. Because I was getting calls. You know, I took a year off between when I left Birmingham, moved back to Mobile, and before I moved to Atlanta, there was almost a year gap there that I didn't work at all, other than I worked one house show for Bill Watson, Bullets in Mississippi. Here's the book. Killed my own show. You guys still there?
I'm here. Do we lose Scott?
There you go. Now, yeah, I'm here now. I got cut on my phone. Cut out. I don't know why it just cut off. I kept saying, "Am I on here?"
This thing live.
So did your I missed just a hair, and then once I got on the queue, I could hear you talking. Did your parents ever actually come watch you wrestle? I might have missed that.
No.
Never did.
None of my family ever saw me wrestle live.
Wow.
Goodness. Mainly because I kept it a secret from them. I would make up. I was going to the beach or something to Pensacola. They never knew I was doing it. I had been wrestling 2 years before they ever knew about it.
Oh, my.
The only reason they found out about it is because the uncle that I was working for in Birmingham, I lived with him until I found her to make enough money to move into a place of my own. And I had two roommates. We lived in a house in Birmingham. This is funny. If there's ever a reason to tell you not to work for family, my uncle, he had his own wallpaper business. He had a partner, and the partner's stepson and I got to be good friends, and we lived together with a third roommate. We split the rent. We split $100 rent between the three of us. We paid $33 a piece.
Wow.
And Mark, one of my roommates, his stepfather, Clay, who was my uncle's business partner, it never failed on Friday. Came time to pay the two of us. They were always a little short of money to afford to pay us off. So we basically lived off my wrestling money. That's how we ate.
Goodness. Goodness.
So don't ever work this.
Jerry, you have any other questions about this? Bobby?
You never tried to go anywhere else, Mike?
I didn't really have contacts anywhere, Jerry, because like I said, I had not worked, you know, on a full-time steady basis. You know, I would pick up matches on the weekends. I'd pick up, you know, go here and do television here, you know. I'd go Dothan and do TV 1 week, and then I'd do Atlanta TV, and then, you know, I wasn't even consistent enough on television where anybody even began to recognize me. Fuller came to me. It was funny how I got booked for that 3 weeks with Fuller. I didn't even know what I was doing. I went to do TV. Jackson, I went down to Dothan to do Dothan TV, and then I was booked to work. We were both booked to work the house show that night. I worked on TV as myself, and then I got to the arena, and they said, while we were there at TV, Bob Armstrong, who was booking, came to me and said, you're working under a hood tonight. And I said, I don't have a mask. And it just happened Mario Galento was there. And Mario Galento came over and said, come go with me. And we walked out to his Cadillac, and he popped open the trunk. He must have had 15, 20 outfits in there.
Wow.
In the car. He said, pick out one. So I was working as Mr. Junior America. So I had red boots. So I said, well, I need something blue and white. But he didn't have any. All he had was a blue outfit, a pair of blue tights, a blue butcher, and an old TKA blue and black mask. So he said, when you're done with it, get it back to me. Well, I ended up working that gimmick for 3 weeks. They had me booked for three solid weeks. I didn't even know about it. I didn't have one change of clothes with me. But luckily, we did Pensacola Sunday, and my parents were in Mobile, so I, you know, was able to go over there and study with them. And then we went to Birmingham Monday night. And I was able to get some stuff there, travel with me. Tuesday was back in Mobile. And Wednesday was Montgomery. Didn't work on Thursday. Friday was always a spot show somewhere, and then Dothan on Saturday. So I did that for 3 weeks. And then at the end of the 3 weeks, that Wednesday night in Montgomery, Ron said, you know, we're done with you. And you know, I was thinking, well, my only choice is to move back to Birmingham. By that time, I had pretty much moved everything back to Mobile as far as my belongings went. And I thought, well, I need to go back to Birmingham, go back to hanging wallpaper, and doing, you know, going over to Atlanta or wherever to do TV. Or I can
try to find something else to do. So I stayed in Mobile and tried to find something else to do. I did that one show in Biloxi, and then moved back to Atlanta. And when I moved back to Atlanta, or moved to Atlanta, or I knew I was moving to Atlanta, I was still living in Mobile. But I took vacation from the job. I was working for Clark Lift of Alabama at that point. I was selling parts. I took a week vacation, went up to Atlanta, which was the girl I was dating at the time. I moved there, who eventually became my wife. And she was after me to move up there and everything. So I thought, well, I'll go up there on vacation. I'll try and reestablish. I worked PBS that week, that Saturday. I worked with Scott Irwin, and that was the last match I had.
Wow.
Bobby Simmons was the office manager, and that was the week that they ran that tape that you and Michael Hayes filmed, Bobby, if you remember it, where Stan and Ole came in and beat him up.
Yeah, we did the thing in the Omni and said we were in Michigan or somewhere.
And the Freebirds had gotten locked. I don't know why they were in Chattanooga the night on Friday night. But everybody was sweating bullets because they were supposed to be at CBS that morning, and they had gotten locked up in Chattanooga the night before. Why Chattanooga was home on Saturday night. Why would you guys have been there on a Friday? Do you remember?
Well, I think we can figure is they went home to Gordy's house and went into Chattanooga to a bar or something.
Well, actually, the Samoans were up there, too, because the Samoans were actually the ones, Apple and Seeker, the ones that really started the fight, and then they left, and Mike and, oh, this is Mike's version of it, Mike and Terry were just sitting there, and the cops were called and said the wrestlers were beating up, you know, customers at the bar. They go in there, and they're the only two wrestlers in there, so they locked them up. But everybody was sweating whether or not they'd make TV that day. They came in.
Huh.
And that was the last show I did. And I
what was your when you were working with Fuller those 3 weeks, who did you usually travel with?
I traveled on my own because everybody lived in Pensacola except me. I lived in Mobile. Mobile, so I traveled by myself pretty much.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, it hadn't been before I moved to Atlanta. I must have done. Yeah, I did. I did one more show for before Ron. I did two more shows for him. When were the Sheepherders there? 82.
I couldn't tell.
But anyway,
tell
you. I did one. I worked Birmingham, and then worked in Pritchard on Tuesday night. I worked a Monday, Tuesday. And I wound up going from, I'd driven over to Pensacola. I was living back in Mobile at that time. I'd driven over to Pensacola and rode to Birmingham with Jill LaDuke, Luke Williams, and Jonathan Boyd.
Oh, I bet that was a trip.
I have never been so scared in all my life. I was the only one that didn't have my own fifth of Jack Daniels, and I was probably the one who needed it the worst because I was terrified. But then we did a show in Pritchard, Alabama, and then that was it until I went to Atlanta and did that one shot on TV, and then I quit. My intentions were to still try and work on the weekends while I was going to school, but then I wound up working for Macy's. And when I got my degree, got my associate's degree from the Art Institute of Atlanta, Macy's offered me an executive position, and I stayed with them for 8 years. That was the end of my career.
Wow. I'm going to go back a little bit again, or actually back to the beginning. Tell me about your very first match, who you wrestled. I don't know if you mentioned that or not. Sometimes I don't hear everything because
no,
I'm thinking about where we're going next.
I wrestled the guy that was the commander on the Naval Air Station. He did a mask gimmick. I can remember what the outfit looked like, but I don't remember what. I think he was called, may have been called the Destroyer or something. But I worked with him.
Okay.
We had another guy that I worked with a couple of weeks later. He was a former amateur. And for the life of me, I cannot remember his name, but he was a good worker, but he was just small. He was probably 5'6", 5'7".
right at 2 and 8. He's about Ted Allen size, if you can picture that. But the guy was a former amateur high school and collegiate wrestler. Was a great guy. He was a lot of help to me when I was training, because that was the only amateur experience I ever had, was him showing me stuff. And I can't remember his name either, but I worked with him one time too. I have to ask Elliot Wiggins next time I did the reunion in Mobile. Doyle's son, Elliot, who was around then, he refereed under the name of Ben Sullivan, did some managing and some stuff later on, but he comes to our reunion every year.
And I was fixing to say, is that the Elliot Wiggins I know?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
He's Mr.
Yeah.
Wiggins.
He's what? Jerry, I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
He's Doyle Wiggins' son.
Okay.
Okay.
Prostate.
Yeah.
His son.
Do you remember being really nervous that first night?
Yeah. Yeah, I never did really get over that.
Not nearly as nervous as the guy he's working with, though.
Good one. But, hey, Mike, Bobby and I work together. We're a tag team. I ask him questions that he can feed off.
I don't know. I was in the ring one time with Ox Baker, and he didn't look nervous at all to me. But
oh, that's a good one.
I moved too quick. That was the one thing that everybody I worked with, they kept telling me, you need to slow down, slow down, slow down, because I was so nervous. You know, if we were scheduled to go 6 or 8 minutes, I'd be done in 3.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you did every move you knew in 3 minutes, and you're like, well, what do we do now?
I can tell you about the highlight of my career, and I blame this on Levi Banks. I got arrested in Selma, Alabama for inciting a riot during the opening match.
Really?
Friday night, yeah. We'd gone over there. Fuller had started running Selma. And at the time, I thought it was the first time they'd run since something happened back in 1976 when Levi Banks was working for Lee Field. He and Burhead Jones caused a riot in that same building. And, they had to sneak Levi out of town and everything. But Joe Turner ended up, he told me he later, he booked and ran shows in Selma. But anyway, the night we were booked there, Jackson and I, we worked quite a bit together because he was still considering himself my trainer. And so we worked quite a bit together. We had a pretty much a routine match. And but when we got to Selma, the two police officers they had there, one of them was the same guy that had been there forever, Captain Green. He was 133 years old. And he had a guy that was probably his son who was 92 years old. And that was all the cops they had. So they said, there'll be no fighting on the outside of the ring. And of course, they only told that to the heels. Well, Jackson was calling the shots in our match, and we had a spot where we did crisscross shoulder tackles, and the last one I sidestepped him and pitched him outside of the ring and come out after him and beat him across on the concrete. So I told Larry Brock, I said, go tell Jackson we can't do that spot. So he came up, went over there and came back and said, Jackson said, just do the match we normally do. So, okay. So we went through all that, boom, 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 boom. I did that, then, he beat me with a Russian leg sweep. I roll out of the ring, and I'm walking back to the dressing room. I got handcuffs on me all of a sudden.
Oh, wow.
I'm carried to the dressing room, sat down. I'm being told to go to jail. And here I am. I'm wearing a pair of red butcher tights, candy apple red boots, and I'm going to jail. I'm thinking, oh, boy, they're going to love me in this place. So wound up, Ron Fuller got involved, and they talked him out of it. But they were going to arrest me for inciting a riot.
Wow.
Wow, this is great. So I told Levi, I said, it's all your fault. You and Bert had started that riot in Selma in 1976, and here I am 5 years later, and I'm getting arrested.
Oh, my.
I could arrest you.
Oh, goodness. What was the hardest thing you found to learn as far as ring work? The hardest, you know, what was the
I never did learn to do it. That spot where you're on the outside of the ring with your hands on the top rope and they slingshot you in, I never could do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I worked, in fact, it was that same night in Selma. I worked the first Battle Royal I ever worked. And that ended up being, even that cost me money. Larry Brock went to the dressing room and said, we need prize money to show the audience. Everybody's got a dollar or two, give it to us.
$2.
Went out there and so they showed the wad to the crowd, and naturally Larry stuck it in his pocket, and I never saw my money.
Oh, no.
But anyway, I had never worked a Battle Royal, so I was in the dressing room, and Saito was there. Saito said, you ever worked a Battle Royal before? And I said, no. He said, well, just don't fall down. He said, keep your hands on the ropes or your arms on the ropes, stay in the corner, whatever. He said, I'll help you out. He was the first one that he eliminated me first. Well, he went to throw me over the top rope, and I panicked. I went over, because I'm so tall, the top rope hit me about midway of my stomach. So I went over, rather than going over at an angle and putting one hand on the apron and pushing myself off, I panicked and went over, bent over double, grabbed both hands on the middle rope, and it slingshotted me off. And I came, flipped over, and hit the small of my back across the ring apron. Wound up with a golf-size knot on my right hip that I had for about 4 months. I never could do stuff like that. I never could learn to throw a working punch. I'd nail you. So I threw forearms, I always did forearms instead of trying to throw a working punch.
A lot of guys feel you shouldn't be throwing punches anyways because it just wasn't believable. I mean, you punch somebody, it's going to really put them down, and forearms were, you know, more believable as far as that goes.
Yeah.
What was your strong points? What was the thing you'd like to do?
I sold real well.
So did your opponents. They didn't have any choice.
I guess I shouldn't ask you any questions about offense. I should just ask you about defense.
the amateur work that I worked with that guy in Pensacola helped me out a lot because I was able to do a lot of switches and stuff like that that you know, most guys, you know, if you watched them on the TVS, you know, they basically just went in and got knocked around. I knew how to wrestle a little bit, so I was able to do reverses and switches and stuff like that. And I was lucky. Most of the guys that I worked with let me do stuff like that. Even the last match I worked on TVS, I worked with Scott Irwin, he was a super destroyer. You know, we started the match. He got me in a hammerlock, and then I reversed out of it, and that, you know, since I knew how to do it, guys would let me do stuff like that.
Cool. Which opponents did you learn the most from, you know, while you wrestled them?
I don't know that I really. I guess I'd have to say with Jackson because he, there was a lot of spots that he taught me how to do that, like, you know, how to go into the corner turnbuckle. He had taught me how to take a few steps and then come off my feet and do stuff like that. I learned a little bit from everybody I worked with because if I saw something, especially if I was able to watch the match later on and would see how they did things, I would, you know, of course, most guys did that. Even though I was in opening matches, I always stood outside the dressing room and watched who was working, and I would take a little bit from this person, a little bit from that person. Norvell helped me out quite a bit. I probably had the best match I ever had in my career, I thought we had with Norvell. He let me get in front of him on offense. I like working with him because if you remember, Norvell always wore
He wore the oldest tights of anybody ever saw. He'd wear them until the elastic wore out on the around the legs. And they were always loose. And so I'd grab him and give him a wedgie every opportunity I had.
Oh, buddy.
So needless to say, his head butts were a little stiff when
Did you ever have trouble understanding when guys called spots in the ring, or did you follow it pretty good?
The only person I ever had trouble with that on was Ken Lucas, because he talked so fast.
Oh, yeah.
But no, most of the spots, you know, we did simple stuff, and I mean, I never really had to do anything elaborate. I was worried when I worked with Scott Irwin, because he did that superplex, was his big finisher, and I guess he decided I was too tall to do that, so we finished with he beat me with a belly superplex instead of a superplex, because I was worried about that. I worked with Snuka one time. You know, he always did that off the top thing, and he slammed me, and I kind of shimmied around and got in position. He went up on the top rope, and I kind of peeked, and I see him up there like this big, huge buzzard up there. And I thought, Lord, this guy's for me. I never felt a thing. He landed on his knees and his elbows. I never felt a thing.
Bobby always talks about being scared of the mauler. You know, was there anybody you felt that way about in the business, even after you got in the business, where you just sort of were apprehensive a bit?
Yes, Archie Goldie. He scared me to death.
Yeah.
He was so into that gimmick of being a stomper, you know, and he was so stern and everything. Of course, he'd come out. The first time I saw him, I had been in, had a handful of matches, you know, and this was in 79. And he came to Mobile, or it might have been a little bit earlier than that. He came to Mobile with Gorgeous George. And I knew George a little bit from when he worked for Lee. But he came out, and Archie went crazy and was struggling and everything. It scared me. I'm sitting at ringside. I got to move. He was wow, man. I'm thinking, I'm in the business. I should know. David Schultz was a little scary, too. I never was around him much. But he could be a little scary, too, because he could look in his eyes and you weren't sure if anybody was home or not.
Yeah. I was around David when he first got into the business, and I just, he wasn't as... know what the word I'm looking for is, intense, I guess, at that time as he was later. So I just never, it never bothered me. But I can see what you say about Archie, absolutely. Did you ever have to do a TV interview?
No.
Okay.
No. I would do, when some of those little outlaw towns and stuff that I was working with, would work with Jackson. Since he was the main event, you know, if I worked with him, I would get to say something on the microphone and stuff. And, I had a neat little routine that I would do. It usually got quite a bit of heat. I would, you know, I'm working all the little small Alabama towns, and I would say, you know, especially if there's one I hadn't worked with, I would say, you know, I thought I was coming to a real city, and I look out here, and all I see are overalls and, you know, people with no teeth and you know, back of dudes running down their chin. And I said, and the men are even worse. You know, so that would give me some heat. And I would tell people, you know, if you're next time I come to this town, I want the ladies dressed in evening wear and wearing gloves, so when they applaud, the applause won't hurt my ears. You know, just stuff like that. And it,
yeah.
I got enough heat just working matches. I was pretty good at generating heat. I was working somewhere, Atala, Alabama, and I had this lady kept on the referee. I was working heel, so I was doing all the hair pulling and trunk pulling and all that stuff. And this lady was hollering at the referee that I was pulling hair and all this kind of thing. So I worked my way over to the ropes where she was sitting, and I leaned over and I pointed at her and I said, "Shut up, you old woman! You can't see past the end of your nose, much less what I'm doing in this ring." So that got her hot. So that's where I got beat in that match. So I rolled out of the ring, and when I did, I stood up. When I stood up, I was standing right in front of her, and she squatted me with a cane. But I enjoyed working heel better than I did babyface. It was easier to work babyface. You didn't have to do all that much. But I just enjoyed getting the reaction to the crowd working heel.
Yeah. It was harder to get over as a babyface if you're a top guy going into a territory. Because a heel, you can do all kinds of stuff.
But
how much time do we have left? I don't want us to go over time. How much?
We've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay. Bobby, anything else?
I think listening to all this, and I've heard Mike talk about his career and all, before, but I think Mike cuts himself short. I mean, if somebody had taken more time with you, really taking time with you.
Yeah, and I agree. And again, no matter what I say about him, I'm grateful to Mike Jackson. He did give me books. He did help me work and everything. But basically, what I was seeing was I was just somebody for him or somebody else to make money off of. The only one.
I
mentioned before Phil Strickland. Mike had probably 15, 20 guys. I helped him train a guy that actually went on and had, it wasn't a long career and it wasn't a great career, but he did well. A guy by the name of Joshua Stroud, who was a friend of Tony Atlas. And I think him knowing Tony opened the doors for him than the training that we did. But he was a bodybuilder type, and he turned out to be a fairly decent worker. And he worked a whole lot of different territories. Going back to what you asked me before about, was I ever, why did I go somewhere else? I didn't have a connection somewhere else. The only people I knew were Jackson. I certainly couldn't go to Ole directly, or wouldn't have.
Jackson has his stable of guys that he made money on. He did the same thing going out to Louisiana for Watts, the TV.
Yeah. Like Josh Stroud, he asked me to go with him one time just to Shreveport to a TV taping, and I didn't go. He took Josh Stroud instead. Yeah, you're right. I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the experience. I just don't know that, given the time frame I was working, the business was starting to change. And to be honest with you, a lot of the guys that I saw in the business at that time, and this is not to speak ill of the dead, but the Buzz Sawyers and the Tommy Rich, I didn't want to be around those people, to be honest with you. Now, had you been around, it's all your fault. Had you been around, I'd have hooked up with you and gotten real training, and I could have been Michael Oates instead of Michael Golden.
There you go. But, I hated to see guys that, you saw that they had potential and, nobody really took the time with them to, just a few things would have helped them so much, but...
Yeah, pretty much basically after I got through with the training that I got from the guys at Tri-State, the little bit of amateur stuff I learned and how to basically do the basic spots, all I was taught was how to take bumps after that and how to sell.
What you say is true, the wrestling business was changing and the territories were sort of, a lot of them were going under, and you just didn't have the opportunity to really learn like you used to.
No, but there were guys, I tell you, I had the opportunity to work with guys like Rocket and Eddie Sullivan and Rip Tyler and Lucas and people that I'd grown up watching, and I'd gotten a chance to work with heroes of mine. I made, what turned out to be, after a few years of not seeing them, but made lifelong friends and people like Ted Allen, Bobby, through the reunions and stuff like that. And like Bobby said, I enjoyed the camaraderie in the dressing room and you know the trips more than I did the actual work in the ring. And that's because I felt, you know, I played a little bit of football in high school, and I played even younger than that. I played a little bit of Little League baseball, but the team thing wasn't as strong doing that as it was in the wrestling business, because there was more of a fraternal type feeling in the wrestling
right
business than other than any other things that I played. And, plus the fact that I was a fan, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, being a fan, I had my ideas when I first decided this is what I wanted to do. I had my ideas as to how well I wanted to present myself, how well I wanted to do. And I just being honest with myself, I knew I'd never reach it. And I didn't want to just be, a scrub.
Yeah.
And but I saw that's what all my role was more than likely going to be. And, so I had the opportunity to do something, earn a living, so I did that instead. I'd never made a living as a wrestler.
Talking about what you said, Jerry, about Mike selling himself short, I agree with you. Going back go ahead.
No, he just had the desire. You know, you hate to see somebody that had that desire and wanted to do it, and you couldn't find somebody to pull it out of him. You know, that's
right.
The sad part.
I haven't tried to beat it out of him.
Going back to what I said at the beginning about all the guys I've interviewed over the past number of years, this is a good example. This interview tonight is just another example of a guy that was just, you know, in a way was sort of on the fringe of the business. You know, he never made it big time, but he has the interview is fascinating to hear Mike's stories. And the thing I like about it, especially about guys like Mike, when you got a guy that sits in an interview and you ask him questions and he comes out and he says, you know, I never was all that good. I was awkward. That's the kind of interviews I like to do. You know, you're not just getting a lot of BS from people. You know, they're telling you the way it was, the way they saw it, and they're not just blowing smoke to make you think they were something great.
He's honest.
What's that?
He's honest. He's telling you how he saw it. You're exactly right.
And what great stories you get from people like that. Mike, I mean, I just commend you. This has been fascinating. Jerry says he's heard a lot of your stories before, but, I've heard bits and pieces on this show. But the reason I wanted to do what I wanted to do tonight was just for the fact that, I wanted to do an interview, in-depth with you just from being. There's a lot. I mean, I barely asked a third of what I was going to ask. You know, we could do more another night, but it's just been, I just want to tell you, I appreciate you doing this. And isn't this better, me doing it the way I did it, than telling you 2 weeks ahead of time and you being nervous for all that time?
Yeah.
You haven't had time to think about it.
Hey, Scott, he'd have given us different stories if he had 2 weeks to think about
it. To think about it, yeah.
he would have made them up.
I'd have come up with a way that only held me back. I was promised the world championship.
Yeah. You were propositioned by the promoter. And I must admit, we kayfabed this pretty darn good because I didn't smart Jerry up till about 8:30 or about 7:30.
Oh, good deal.
I called him and told him what we were doing, so.
Well,
I was going to call you, Jerry. Jerry, I was going to call you and tell you that, and I thought, no, I'm just going to let it go. And Bobby's the only one I told, and I thought it would be just a nice surprise for Mike.
It was good. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Well, guys, we got about 2 minutes left, and before we go, I want to say two things. Scott, first of all, and I should have done this when you first got on with us, condolences on the loss of your father-in-law. And,
thank you.
Sorry for your loss.
Thank
you.
I totally had that screwed up because Mac. I got the email from Mac saying John Walker, and I'm who am I thinking of?
thank goodness I was online. I was on Facebook when MacPat pasted that, thank goodness I was, because as soon as I saw it, it popped up, and I called Mac right away. I said, you've got to take that down. He says, I don't know how. And I said, well, give me your password and your username. And I took it down, and sure enough, three or four people saw it before he did, but then I posted something about, you know, it's my father-in-law. And thank goodness I did, because it would have been all over everywhere, you know, that Johnny Walker had passed away.
Certainly, condolences on that. It's not an easy thing. He just lost his
brother.
Thank you. Ago, so. Sure. Our thoughts and prayers that they live you. And I told this about the other thing about
them,
so,
you know, hey, I know we're getting close, but let's do a book plug while, for our buddy Chuck Thornton while we got Scott here. He can tell a little bit more about it than I know, just what I saw, but. Chuck's done a book that's Crowbar Press is expanding. They're doing cowboy books now.
I don't know if we're expanding. We did that one anyway. It's a great book. It's called Durango. It's about the life of it's about Charles Sterrett. He was in I think it was 167 or 67 movies about the character called Durango, the old Western character.
Charles Sterrett was also, and I just read this in the magazine here today, earlier today, he was also one of the organizers that started the Screen Actors Guild, along with Boris.
Absolutely. Powell. That's right.
The other thing I was going to say is next month we will be celebrating our 2-year anniversary, the three of us doing this show. You believe it's been 2 years?
Wow. Congratulations, guys! It's the best show. I listen to every Thursday. The only thing about me being on this show, I won't listen to it tonight. Usually, it gets me through the night driving. I drive from midnight till 8 a.m, and it gets me through the night. But I sort of won't have it tonight.
We'll go pick one of our greatest hits from the past and listen to that.
I'll do that. Well, thank you all for allowing me to do this.
I tell you guys, I appreciate this. I've never thought I'd do it. This is my life, but I appreciate it. Scott, I appreciate you joining us as always. Hopefully, I haven't confirmed it yet, but next week we're hoping to have Bo James and Tom Pritchard on with us. So, guys, tune in for that one. And we are going to say goodnight, and we will talk to you guys next week. Thanks again, guys.
Good night, guys.
See y'all. Good night, guys. Thanks, Scott.
Bye-bye.